Welcome to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Emails of the Democratic National Committee were leaked this summer, allegedly by Russian hackers. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell's personal emails were recently leaked. Last year, a Chinese hack exposed the personal data of millions of Americans by breaching databases belonging to the United States Office of Personnel Management. So what about our voting systems? How secure are they, and what threat do hackers pose? Joining me is Dr. Richard Forno, a senior lecturer in the UMBC Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering, where he directs the UMBC Graduate Cybersecurity Program and serves as the assistant director of UMBC's Center for Cybersecurity. He recently wrote about this issue in a piece for The Conversation titled, How Vulnerable to Hacking is the U.S. Election Cyber Infrastructure? Welcome to On the Record.
Good to be here.
I mentioned several highly publicized hacks. Do you have a sense of what risk voting machines face from overseas or criminal entities?
Well, I think we have to separate the issue between the voting machines and the overall voting process, because the two are related, but they have very different threat and vulnerability characteristics. The voting machines are what's getting all the attention these days. The fact that somebody is alleged to be able to modify a citizen's vote in the voting booth, that has received a lot of media attention from the candidates even. But my worries are the larger voting process itself, the technology surrounding how the voting data is counted and tabulated and ultimately reported. The machines are just one part of the overall system that has vulnerabilities.
Machines are one part, and the parts that you're more worried about are?
Well, I would say I'm equally worried. I'm not more worried. I'm equally worried about, for example, the machines that count the votes cast at a given polling place. Maybe you have 10 electronic voting machines, and they report their votes to a laptop across the room. How is that machine protected? How is the machine that that computer talks to as it reports the voting data up the chain to Annapolis? How are those systems protected? How is the data, the voting data that counts, being protected as this information moves through the system? So it's much more than just the point where the citizen punches yes or no.
But it's like the internet. I mean this as a question, not a statement. It's all about the connections, right? It is when data is moving that it's most likely to be corrupted, right?
Data can be corrupted in transit when it's moving, and also certainly, when it's stationary. You know, you have these voting machines and these precincts that send data to another server somewhere to get stored and then counted. Well, when that data is sitting on that other server, maybe it's vulnerable while it's just sitting there. So it's really, you're looking at a range of security concerns that starts with the individual voting machine in the voting booth, all the way up through to the systems that officially record and report out the outcomes of an election.
Maryland has new voting machines this year, but in the article that I mentioned that you wrote, How Vulnerable to Hacking is the U.S. Election Cyber Infrastructure, you noted that electronic voting machines in 43 of 50 U.S. states are at least 10 years old. Why have states let them stagnate?
I think really it comes down to it's money. These machines are computer systems, and they're hardware, and this stuff needs to be maintained regularly as new vulnerabilities are discovered and systems need to be patched. Just the way you update your home computer with new security features, these machines also need to be updated regularly, but that costs money. And ever since the great financial crisis, if not before, states are hurting for money, so there are competing priorities for a very limited range of financial resources. Voting machines apparently have not gotten that high of a priority yet.
Would you expect the attention in this election campaign to change state priorities in that regard?
I think it certainly has raised this to a national conversation about how we conduct voting nationally and certainly within the states. I would hope that this serves as a renewed starting point to keep this discussion going so that the next election that comes around, maybe there is funding available or other processes in place that can lead to more trustworthy voting processes.
One of the things you wrote in your article about the vulnerability of the cyber infrastructure, among other efforts, the Soviet Union spread conspiracy theories about government officials and fabricated documents intended to exploit the social tensions of the 1960s. Is that history that's done and over?
Well, I think the practice of one country looking at another country's electoral process and possibly taking steps overtly or covertly to influence elections is not new. The Russians tried to do it to us during the Cold War. We did it to them and other countries. That's not a new process. When we add computers into the mix, suddenly it becomes a 21st century concern. But really, it's just traditional, intelligence and political warfare techniques moving into the information age.
So you were not shocked by the headlines this summer?
Not in the least. It was not surprising to see that this stuff happens. Just as with other hacking, if one country is hacking another country, nobody really can say we're the innocent victim here because everybody does it to everybody else.
That's Dr. Richard Forno, senior lecturer in the UMBC Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering and assistant director of UMBC's Center for Cybersecurity. Here on The Record on WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. What are the risks when you don't run updates or replace technology for a long period of time?
There are several risks. Firstly, if you have a system, a computer that has not been updated or it was built 10 years ago and it has never been updated, in that time, researchers and hackers have looked at these systems to identify vulnerabilities or potential vulnerabilities and have developed ways of perhaps exploiting these vulnerabilities to cause mischief. So if you have a computer that you've not updated for years, it's woefully behind the curve, if you will, in protecting its data from the bad guys. So it's these systems, the electronic voting systems, and the other computers elsewhere in the election infrastructure are, you treat them in this regard no different than a home computer or a work computer. They need money and constant care and feeding over time.
Which a lot of us are really slow to do. I mean, all of a sudden you've made me sort of sympathetic to election boards that haven't figured out how to do this.
Sure.
What are the other weak spots outside the polling booth?
Sure. And the polling booth is where a lot of the attention has been given because you've got electronic voting machines and touch screens, and that's kind of the high-tech, glitzy cyber aspect of voting. But I've been asking, and I look at voting more broadly as a complete system, one that is based on trust, number one, trust in the process, trust in the technology, trust in the data itself. So I look at things like who's allowed to vote. States have systems where you could register to vote online, their voter registration databases. I worry that someone might show up to a polling place at 5 o'clock in the morning, be the first person online, show their ID, and they'll be told, well, the system says you've already voted. What does that type of a technical hiccup do to people, not only in terms of the voting process, but just in the level of trust we have in the voting system? So the voter registration database run, each state has them, maybe even cities and counties do, are systems no different than what you'd find at your bank or Amazon or eBay, that the information on those databases needs to be protected so that the data, the voter registration information, who is allowed to vote, is we can trust that data, trust that information. And we don't have a case where a bad guy, whoever or wherever they are, is suddenly able to create 5,000 phantom new voters in a given precinct and potentially skew election outcomes.
Well, the concern about voter fraud, we've heard mostly in news coverage in the context of requiring voters to present some kind of ID, photo ID in particular, and whether that is, is fair to some categories of voters. It sounds to me as if you're saying that presenting ID on site is only a small part of the way voter fraud could be committed.
Yes. I mean, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but as a security person, that's kind of our job, is to look at all the possible avenues that, you know, however far-fetched they might be, and think about how likely a given scenario may happen. Yes, showing ID at the polling place is a good step. But if that ID is not verified with some other database, okay, there's no way to know that the ID, the driver's license that you're showing, is real or fake.
Does the fact that there is not one universal voting system in the U.S., that is, each state has its own, does that make us less safe, or is that an advantage? Is it a feature or a flaw?
It's both. On one hand, it's a disadvantage because we have a hodgepodge of systems that are controlled by state and local governments, and there is no central single technology best practice that can be mandated. On the flip side, looking at it from a security perspective, it also maybe makes it a little difficult to quote-unquote hack the election, because you have a hodgepodge of systems in every state and within every state. So it's, in some ways, it's easier, or I say it's worse to secure these systems because they're so decentralized, but I think it also makes it a little more difficult for a bad guy to create widespread havoc because the systems are so varied in how they're deployed around the country.
Except presumably a bad guy would do kind of what the news media does and really focus on a few swing states with a significant number of electoral votes, at least in terms of the presidential race.
Yeah, very much so. And I worry that we're going to have a scenario very similar to the 2000 Florida ballots with the hanging chads and that iconic picture of the poll judge with a magnifying glass looking at the punch card. But it's what we call security by obscurity. And some argue it works. Others say it doesn't work. In this case, we're still in the early innings of using electronic voting in this country. So there's going to be growing pains and learning curves. And I think if we were having this conversation 10 or 20 or 30 years from now, we'd have a much more robust, reliable, hopefully standardized national system to cast votes. A big problem is states will reserve the right for voting. One of the questions I've been asked repeatedly is, well, how come the federal government can't mandate a single system for voting across the country? And my response is, well, now you're running into the question of states' rights. And the states are going to say, number one, who's paying for the system? And number two, we want to do something a little differently than our neighboring state. And we have that right under the Constitution. No politician is going to want to open that can of worms. That's just a very messy situation.
Marylanders are voting by paper ballots this year. What are the upside? I mean, I think to some people that may seem backward. They don't do much anything else on paper these days, and other people may think that's safe. I know paper. How does it look to you as an expert?
I think just because the technology is old doesn't mean it's outdated or not useful anymore. I mean, just look at the iPhone 7. There's no headphone jack, and people are either very happy or very upset by that. It's old technology, but it still works in many, many cases. Paper ballots, I think, serve a place. It's a useful technology. It is technology, if you think about it. It also allows you to have a receipt. And some of these electronic machines even produce a paper receipt that you can take home with you. So if there is ever a challenge and you're not sure that your vote was counted correctly, you can present the paper ballot and say, this is how I voted. That's not what you're reporting if there's a problem. So in some ways, I think the older technology may be a more trustworthy technology, at least in the present moment.
So looking at the overall system and applying your priorities, what recommendations do you make to ensure security?
It's a wide-ranging set of priorities because we have so many different levels of computers and technology involved. The first level, the voting machines, they need to be properly updated, upgraded, locked down, whatever it takes, and that costs money. So I don't see that happening anytime soon. Beyond that, the systems that hold the voter registration data, the vote data itself as it moves through the system on election night, those systems need to be protected using best practices of computer security, stuff that we've been preaching in the industry for 20 or 30 years. Protecting voter registration and vote data is not that different from securing any other type of data. It's just obviously much more critical and sensitive in the public eye because of what it represents to this country. And assuring, taking whatever steps we can to raise the level of confidence and trustworthiness in the data and the process itself is where we need to be heading.
You've given us a lot to think about. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Richard Forno is a senior lecturer in the UMBC Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering. He's director of the UMBC Graduate Cybersecurity Program and assistant director of UMBC's Center for Cybersecurity. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, producer Andrea Appleton talks to a director participating in a festival of film shorts. Stay with us for that.